this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. There's most definitely movement in the collective consciousness of New Zealanders, as each day we realise that if we want to have more say in the way our country is being run, be it from a local government or central government, the time really is now. Ever since the British people voted to leave the European Union and exit the failed neoliberal economic experiment, this has enlivened the debate as to how we can govern ourselves. Here in New Zealand, the opportunities are potent with possibility as we are waking up to the realisation that we can use our financial firepower to buy only that which is going to benefit our health and our family well-being. So, going as organic as possible is catching on too, as the organic sector grew at 11% this year and organic dairy farmers were able to get $9.20 a kilogram of milk solids as against $4.70 for conventional farmers. We now know where the market is trending. However, on the downside, we are also starting to realise the collateral damage of Monsanto's glyphosate, and there's an urgent call to halt the spraying of this deadly toxin, particularly in the cities and around parks, as tests have shown it to be ubiquitous in more and more of our foods. Fortunately, with the internet and Facebook, we are starting to get savvy as to how to use this medium, and we are connecting and reconnecting faster and faster as we link up to show that we are part of a unified field that is starting to wake up the collective in an increasing state of awareness. And we must continue this day and night in talking up positive change, because this is a time when we can vote to take our councils back and give the youth of the nation a chance to see that individually we can make a difference as we factor our children and grandchildren into a future that we can all look forward to. On the phone from Havelock North, I have Phyllis Tichenin, and she's the CEO and founder of True Health, and she has a vast knowledge, particularly of the agricultural sector, the way we deal with food, grow food, also the health of our gut, and how that relates to the soil health on our farms, etc. So I wish to say kia ora and thank you for wanting to come and share with us this morning, Phyllis.
My pleasure.
Phyllis, you originally came from Santa Clara in California, and you tell a very interesting story about your mum. She was very keen to make sure that when the cows of your farm produced milk, they had the best quality soils, the best quality grasses to eat, and you could drink at will very, very healthy milk. Can you explain a little bit about your past and how it has led you to New Zealand and what you do here today?
I grew up in Northern California. My parents were sort of what we would call lifestyle farmers, but my mother came from a rural background and a dairying background particularly, and my father was an extension agent for the University of California, so he specialized in deciduous fruits and nuts and their care in the Santa Clara Valley, which was like Hastings here in New Zealand. It was the fruit bowl of the United States. It had fantastic soils and water and a wonderful climate. And as a result, unfortunately, as I was growing up, it became rampant subdivisions and eventually the computer industry and Silicon Valley. So now, unfortunately, we have hundreds of square miles of some of the world's best soil covered in concrete, which, as that was happening from the age I was 4 or 5 onwards, I saw that transformation occur, and I think it impacted me deeply in my sense of horror that such productive soils and such beautiful trees and fruit-growing potential was killed, basically. So I ended up going to university and getting a degree in environmental management and planning. I met a Kiwi at University of California at Davis who was doing his graduate degree in ecology because he was very interested in the regulation of pesticides and how pesticides affect the environment. And we ended up getting married, and I continued my career in California state government in coastal regulation and then in energy conservation, and that eventually morphed into land waste disposal of hazardous substances, and it took me on a sort of a circular path that eventually came back to my interest in and training in agriculture through University of California at Davis. So it was this connection between knowing about the harm that pesticides do, knowing about soils, and then attending and having a lifelong interest in nutrition because my mother had been very keen for us to have wholemeal bread and grow our own food and no processed food or Oreos or Twinkies for us as children, much to our chagrin when we opened our lunches at school. But in hindsight, it's really been a tremendous leg up for me and for all of my siblings in terms of our health, and it certainly laid the foundation for my connections with nutrition and health for humans and animals from the soil up, and with that overlay of the understanding of the roles that pesticides play in agriculture and the harm that they actually do to soil microbes and ultimately to our water and health has been a major theme for me over the last 20 years that I've been here in New Zealand. So I am the owner of True Health, which is mostly an animal remedies firm. I import organically certified tinctures, so plant-based extracts and essential oil blends to act as alternatives to antibiotics for the dairy industry to help farmers wean themselves off their reliance on antibiotics for treating cow ills and hopefully, you know, encourage them to move down a more biological or organic path for restoring fertility to their soils and reducing the number of ill animals that they have while producing better milk. So that's the bulk of what I'm doing now. Plus, I have a farm at the back of Cape Kidnappers, 48 hectares, where I have a dairy support unit. As I like to say, I have a fat farm. So my goal is to grow animals on the best, well-remineralized soils, growing diverse pastures that are high bricks, creating cows that are plump and happy and produce medicinal quality milk with lots of saturated animal fat on the meat itself and in the butter fat that I create, because I'm very keen to see us increase our consumption of those medicinal and highly beneficial saturated animal fats like butter and tallow and pork lard that we used to thrive on two or three generations ago. And I believe we're seeing the decline that we're seeing in human health across the board and all of these inflammatory disorders like diabetes, like autism, like cancer, and immune system collapse is a result of poor nutrition and specifically inadequate cholesterol and saturated animal fat in our diet.
It's a growing challenge at the moment, Phyllis. I'm in touch with a veterinary person who works in the farming sector here in the Waikato, and he talks about huge problems when it comes to just spraying of particularly glyphosate on the land, and within 4 days cows are allowed to come in and eat the grass or the foliage that has been sprayed. And my concern naturally goes to the fact that children now are suffering from so many allergies, and the stats just keep increasing that where 100 years ago one person maybe in 100 may have died from cancer, now it's nearly one out of two people. So there are huge, huge needs for us to start again in many ways, or we can't really do that, but what we need to do is find people at the leading edge of farming and land management philosophies, as well as holistic technologies. And you have followed closely with Arden Anderson and Graham Satan, Biological Agriculture. Could you talk a little bit about that, or you may wish to lead into that from another interest of yours?
Well, thank you. Absolutely. I'm happy to talk about Arden Anderson and Graham Sate. They've been instrumental in educating farmers in Australia and in New Zealand. Graham is from Australia, and I had the honor of bringing him over to do multiple biological agriculture courses, and it's been heartening to see how many hundreds of farmers are now have soils that are more minerally balanced, more microbially alive and diverse, and as a result, they are producing more pasture of better quality and more fruits and vegetables that actually store well, taste great, and have higher mineral and vitamin content, or as we call it, higher BRICS, so higher total dissolved solids, which indicates that the food is going to be better for us. We're trying to create from the soil up food that actually heals people, that nourishes them deeply to the point that they have the building blocks of minerals to create the enzymes and the tissues with integrity that actually translate into full and optimal health. And unfortunately, we know this from food basket surveys of mineral and vitamin content from multiple ones from the United States, from the UK Royal Society of Chemists and their NAS equivalent, from Germany, from around the world, that the percentage of vitamin and minerals in our food across the board has declined markedly in the last 70 to 80 years, and the decline continues, and that decline is linked to the way we've been doing agriculture, i.e. the way we've been fertilizing, and in turn the application of pesticides and herbicides that, as Graham Sate says, balm the microbe bridge that allows minerals to be absorbed by the plant in their ideal and proper forms. If that isn't happening, it's just the start of a slippery slope towards plants that aren't all there, that don't have strong stems, that don't have tissue integrity, that don't have the enzymes and the antibiotics and the oomph, if you will, the energy, the literal fuel, to create the communication molecules, the pest repellent tissues that they need to avoid a need for pesticides. And that's a key concept of biological agriculture. You've got to have high BRICS plants, which means the minerals are getting in the right form, at the right time, in the right quantities to create the tissues in a plant that do not attract diseases, parasites, microbes, insects. Therefore, they don't need anything like the application that standard conventional crops need in order to reach maturity. They can defend themselves. In fact, they don't even attract pests. And that is key in regenerating our soils to the sort of quality that can actually produce medicinal foods, because every application of pesticide, every application of superphosphate or urea that hasn't been buffered by a humic acid or some form of complex carbon will only push the necessary mineral balance backwards, and it will suppress the microbial community that we need functioning for healthy plants. So it's a slippery slope and a downward spiral, because the more pesticides we use, the more the crop needs, because it's every time weaker. So that explains, in part, the continuing increase in pesticide use around the world. It's not that we're growing more food or that the pests are more virulent. It's the fact that the plants themselves are actually weaker because of how we're treating the soils and doing agriculture.
So in essence, Phyllis, this is a grassroots revolution yet again. And I've been involved in so many grassroots situations, but with farming and with biological farming and with Christine Jones and Arden Anderson and Graham Saint, these people who have grabbed and run with this because there's such a necessity for us to really turn this around. When we look at government, the bodies that are supposed to make sure that there are less poisons in the environment, etc., we're not getting any leadership from them. And so it's essentially a grassroots revolution from now on, isn't it?
Yeah, I would take it so far to say if there's leadership in the regulatory agencies like the United States EPA or even our New Zealand EPA or the New Zealand and Australian Food Standards Safety Authorities, and similarly, this is not just New Zealand, Australia, and the United States. It's across the board with most all countries, regulatory authorities when it comes to the environment and specifically when it comes to agricultural chemicals and hazardous substances. We have the impression, because there are laws on the books that seem to be reasonably robust, that we are being protected. We are not only leaderless, we are not being protected by the likes of the US EPA, which over the last 50 years or so has been the key agency worldwide approving, in this instance that I'm going to talk about, herbicides or pesticides for use. So it has some reasonably robust standards. In appearance, the dilemma, and it's universal, is that the companies who, like DuPont or Bayer or Syngenta or Monsanto, who want to register herbicides or pesticides, are allowed to submit, in quotes, safety, end quote, studies, research that they paid for as justification or proof of the safety of the substances that they're asking to bring onto the market. Now, you could argue that, well, EPA doesn't have the money to do that sort of thing. And a response to that is fine. Charge more for the application and let the EPA do that research independently. There have been multiple examples of fraudulent data, so data that was manipulated, the numbers were changed to make the product look safe, or the research wasn't done at all, i.e. they completely made up the safety data and submitted it. People in the United States from laboratories, supposedly independent laboratories, are now in jail for having done that. Huge fines have been paid, but it doesn't really seem to change anything.
Because
what ends up happening is, from a political science standpoint, and this was generally at the topic of my husband's PhD thesis, is in the United States, and we all rely on the U.S. EPA safety studies for approving chemicals worldwide. The problem is that from the beginning, EPA was not provided the funding to actually hire the quantity and caliber of scientists to be able to evaluate those industry-generated safety studies in the first place. So it's actually quite a cozy little circle where the industry, chemical industry lobbyists are cozy with the chairman of the Senate Agricultural Committee in U.S. Congress, for example, and they make sure that the EPA actually has a very, very modest budget, and they can never really keep up with the industry-bought scientists. And if they do, usually they don't last very long. So there is that, not only is there the revolving door where the head of EPA or the head of U.S. Department of Food and Agriculture or some other regulatory agency happens to have been chief counsel for Monsanto, for example. That definitely has happened. And they put him in charge of approving genetically engineered crops in the early 90s. Multiple examples of where someone who worked for the industry ends up being in a position to regulate the industry. It's perfectly clear that that's not going to work out for for our best interest as consumers and citizens, but it happens, unfortunately, all the time, and it takes a very brave politician to break that mold. So I'm afraid unless we vote with our dollars as food consumers and consumers of services to make it very clear that we understand what's going on and we're not going to have a bar of it, very little will change. You do, unfortunately, in my experience, need multiple dead people. Babies are especially good for this. Before the level of public outrage becomes sufficient, that at least a small step will be made to clean up the regulatory act. And I've seen multiple examples of this. We had Love Canal toxic waste next to a new subdivision or on top, you know, underneath a subdivision. We've had multiple contaminated, PCB contaminated waste being oil being sprayed on roads throughout the United States and people being very sick. We have the whole vaccine and autism issues now. We have cancer staring us in the face. All of these conditions are traced back to poor nutrition or the inability to actually get adequate, optimal nutrition to create healthy bodies and environmental toxins. Those are the two major routes by which we get both cancer and this host of inflammatory disorders. And pesticides and herbicides are a major contributor to that because they are so ubiquitous. They are not just in the agricultural growing areas, and this is not just a problem with the children of farmers. It is universal because of the residues on the plants and because of the amount of pesticide and herbicide that gets sprayed in urban areas to keep a pristine lawn or to spray one's vegetables or roses. So it's not just something agriculture does, but it's certainly the model that agriculture creates of the farmer waking up in the morning and first thing you think of is not what am I going to grow today, but what do I need to kill today? Am I drenching sheep? Am I spraying a herbicide? Am I out there putting on an insecticide plume onto my orchard? It's agriculture, unfortunately, has become a killing field instead of a growing field.
I hear you very clearly. I spent time with people with the organic farm, and they can't wait to wake up in the morning and go out and spend time with their crops or with their animals and know that what they're putting into their farm is going to nourish so many people, and it nourishes themselves, of course, so they're optimistic and they're just wanting to participate, and yet they're surrounded by all this major unknowingness of what we call conventional farming. So it's a huge challenge, and I want to say again just here, thank you very much for articulating that clearly, Phyllis, because it's in many ways Mother Earth, planet Earth, is under assault. And you can really see this because of the extractive enterprises going on all the time, be it drilling, be it mining, be it cutting down forests, etc. We don't understand reciprocity. I mean, we get all our air, we get our water and our food from our planet, yet there's this unknowing about the fact that without this produce coming to us, the human species wouldn't exist.
An awakening that I'm heartened by, that I'm seeing in the last 4 to 5 years, is the broader realization that microbes are the key to our planet functioning.
Yes.
And directly to our health. And it's, everybody knows about probiotics in yogurt, or everybody's closer to understanding that if you can avoid antibiotics and deal to it some other way, your gut will be in better shape, and that, you know, for them vaguely means sort of better health, and they're absolutely right about that. But what we are seeing in terms of the research, particularly human gut microbiome, and microbiome is the science term for the community or the ecology of microbes in whatever system they're in, whether that's the water microbiome or the soil microbiome or our human gut microbiome. And what they're highlighting is the absolute importance of having diverse, integrated, healthy communities, an ecology, within not only our gut, but on our skin, in our tissues, even in our blood. And certainly they're realizing that all of the Western world's gut microbiome has been seriously compromised by antibiotics, by herbicides, by pesticides, all of which are sides. Again, they're biocides. They're meant to kill biology. And the microbes that drive our digestion in our gut, that are our protection against infection from the outside on our skin, all of those microbes are sensitive to antibiotics, to personal care products that we use that have toxic chemicals in them pretty universally, to any form of herbicide or pesticide. So what we're seeing is the realization that a major contributor to human ill health, and as it declines generation after generation, is the fact that we've been poisoning through the environmental chemicals and the agricultural chemicals our gut microbiome. And without that, we get improper digestion of our food, we get leaky gut syndrome, holes in our intestine that shouldn't be there, that allow particles of food that aren't fully digested through. Those are, our body doesn't recognize those. We mount a response to them, and that becomes an allergy or a food intolerance. We get candida infections that send hyphae and create toxins throughout our body, and they're beginning to realize that there is a direct, powerful link. They call it the vagus nerve that goes from our gut to our brain. And the quality of our gut microbiome literally can control our moods, our thoughts, our feelings, depending upon the state of health of our gut. And that's the big one. They know that the risk for Alzheimer's increases dramatically if we don't have a healthy gut. Bottom line is, nobody in the Western world, with few exceptions, actually has a robust, healthy gut, because in order to have a robust, healthy gut, you need to have not ever had any antibiotics, not ever had any anti-inflammatory, even across the ibuprofen type aspirin anti-inflammatory combination painkillers, and been born not by C-section of a woman who had never had any of those other things either. Now, I challenge anyone to show me someone born in the last 60 years who actually fits into that category. So as a result, we're all kind of limping along with a compromised gut microbiome. And absolutely, there are ways of dealing to that, like the GAPS, G-A-P-S diet cleanse, to eliminate all sources of carbohydrate, which is what most of the bad guys in our gut, including the fungi, tend to thrive on. Those are not protocols for the faint-hearted. It does require preparation, but it certainly is possible to do. But it is another weak link in our overall chain of health, the impact that agricultural chemicals and antibiotics are having on our health and the health of our children. And one of the main ones that is being uncovered now is the fact that Roundup, it was the Monsanto trade name for a product, glyphosate, which is now marketed by any number of companies as a broad-spectrum weed killer. So it kills pretty much all living plant tissue. There are a few exceptions, and those exceptions tend to be the Roundup Ready, or GMO, corn and soy and canola. So we're seeing, as the amount of glyphosate trebles and quadruples. I've seen between 800,000 and a million tons of glyphosate used annually worldwide. That is definitely in our water, in our air, in our soil, and in every aspect of our food. It is an antibiotic. We're receiving it in small, continual doses through our food, and that is the optimal way for creating and maintaining poor gut microbe health by giving constant low doses of an antibiotic. That is just one almost minor aspect of the downsides and the serious health impacts that glyphosate has. It locks up minerals to the point where it's difficult for our body to get full nutrition. It directly causes infertility in all mammals. It blocks our transport of sulfur within our body, and it shuts down our ability to detoxify environmental toxins through the, wait for it, the cytochrome P450 enzyme pathway, which is part of our liver's system for detoxifying chemicals. So not only is glyphosate an antibiotic, but it shuts down our own ability to detoxify glyphosate itself and most all other environmental toxins. So you can see how as the glyphosate level of use increases over the last 30 to 40 years, particularly on GMO crops, we are having unprecedented surges that are alarmingly correlated statistically in things like Alzheimer's, cancers, breast cancer in particular, non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. Autism is the big one. The strongest correlation is between Roundup or glyphosate use and autism, because autism, one of the major aspects of autism is gut microbiome dysfunction and lack of sulfur transport. So those two definitely link up. We're beginning to get to the point where the experts are predicting we're not going to have a population overdose, so to speak, or we're not going to have a population blowout worldwide. Fertility rates are plummeting throughout the Western world and the Third World as well. And we are having in the First World and increasingly in less developed countries an autism epidemic, which puts into question how are we going to function as a society when one out of five or six males in particular, but females as well, is autistic and cannot function in a normal basis, hold down a job, be reliable, interact with people in a what we consider to be a normal way. So it's a huge, huge issue.
It certainly is. It's a real big one. I'm speaking with Phyllis Tichenin. She has a degree in environmental planning and management, and she is very focused on health and what we take into our bodies. And she is the owner of True Health Limited in Havelock North in the Hawke's Bay. I want to just go back a little bit. I work in a holiday park, and I have to go around and check all the facilities, and I'm noticing a lot when I go into the men's toilets or women's toilets, and I look at the back of the toilet pan and I realize that it's basically splattered on so many occasions. There's no real stool being dropped, for want of a better word, and it means that people are eating so much rubbishy food that their stool cannot bind. And I've noticed this now for years, and naturally, I want to make sure my own intestines are processing my very much whole type food that I'm eating. So it's very, very predominant. This fact is that people's bowels are just so loose. Believe it or not, I'm noticing this. And as for all the other, we have compliant people in so many areas where there are nodal points or they're gatekeepers. in so many sectors or departments that relate to the big pharmaceutical companies, spin doctors, communicating to our government saying, look, we want to be able to give you this for your hospitals or this for your agricultural sector. Or we are under a huge assault by very cashed up vested interests of big business, agribusiness, just steamrolling over which was once a little country that had the possibility of being the food bowl for the Pacific Basin. And we're on the back foot, essentially. And so I'm glad that you could articulate it, Phyllis, clearly, because we have to organise. And one of the things about this Green Planet FM radio program is that we're here to ignite and mobilise consciousness at a grassroots level. This can only get worse, what's happening in the world, unless we come together in cells and groups of cells and clusters of cells and start connecting in a very holistic way. And I know that you have a situation in the Hawke's Bay, Napier, Hastings area where farmers are wanting to make sure that whole district is deemed a GE and GMO free area. And the government in New Zealand is in many ways wanting to take the power away from the Napier Council and the Hastings Council and most probably the Havelock Council, so that you can't enact your own laws to make sure that your district is a GE and a GMO-free area, that the government wants it to be given to the health boards, and then the health boards will do what the government says. So there's a big, huge battle of power going on, as well as the government wants to centralise more and more power, when in actual fact a decentralised way of living should be far, far beneficial, because the people in the local areas can communicate with their local councillors and their local mayor, and so everything works out well. But when you have Wellington deciding for the whole country, that's becoming a real issue of control, isn't it?
Well, I have a sort of diversion slash correction on that, Tim. Pure Hawke's Bay, the growers group behind the Hastings District Council 10-year prohibition through the land use plan on release of GMOs in agriculture, or any GMO trials or crops outside, so with agriculture, we wouldn't have a problem with EPA, with whom that initial decision to prove a GMO crop rests, if they had a better track record. So far, EPA and its precursor, IRMA, have approved every single application for a GMO trial that has come to them, and there have been over 60, you know, greenhouse trials, or in some instances at Lincoln in the last 4 or 5 years, actual outdoor trials. After all of that expense, after all of the hype, none of those GMO trials actually resulted in anything that was commercializable, and ran tremendous risks of releasing GMO constructs, foreign proteins, into the environment that would be, as far as we can see from a science standpoint, pretty much impossible to retrieve or clean up or pull back out of that microbial environment. Now, that doesn't give us a lot of faith in EPA, but a major problem is EPA has the right to tell a local district that they will have a GMO crop in their region, and that, for example, the Hastings District Council's objection or comments about that, or raising concerns, carries no more weight than if you wrote to IRMA or EPA saying, I really don't think it's a good idea to release this GMO crop in the Hastings District. There is no avenue for local concerns to be covered, and there is a major hole in the liability provisions in this EPA GMO approval regime. No insurance company has been willing so far to provide liability insurance for a GMO crop, certainly not here in New Zealand, and they have great difficulty with it anywhere else in the world. So who carries the can if there is a release or there is damage in the environment or in the water. That's a major question for local governments, and one of the reasons behind why Hastings District Council and now Auckland and Northland have moved or are moving towards land use prohibitions at the local level to provide them some level of input and protection. So I'm not against having EPA make a science-based decision. I think they just need to be more objective about it and actually look at what's happening worldwide with the problems of herbicide-resistant weeds and the impact that it appears to be having on human health, human fertility, and the whole range of inflammatory disorders, that many of which can be correlated with the arrival and ubiquitous consumption of GMO crops. And they will say there have been no human health studies indicating that there is any problem with GMO food. I can send them at least five or six that have shown that. The problem is, studies that show harm, absolutely, there are there. What they're in effect saying is, we don't think it has any harm because we think it's substantially equivalent to standard food. That was a complete and absolute construct of Michael Taylor, who used to work for Monsanto, who then went on to work for the U.S. Department of Food and Drugs in the United States, who made that determination against the advice of their scientists that GMO crops were substantially equivalent to standard crops. We have never had a long-term human study that proves that GMO foreign proteins are safe in our body, and there are now multiple studies indicating in laboratory animals that it is actually harmful and that it does prompt tumors and it does damage kidneys and liver. So I think we really do need to look at it from a health standpoint, but from Purox Bay standpoint, it is being viewed as a marketing issue. It's a branding issue. The science, we could argue till the cows come home. No one can argue with the fact that our high-end markets in China, in Asia, in the United States even, and in Europe are not willing to pay a premium for GMO. In fact, the opposite. They're willing to pay a premium for non-GMO or organic. And that has to be the road that we go down for our own economic profit and viability. We don't move into the science space with that as an organization, Purehawks Bay. We argue it from the standpoint that our markets don't want it. We have a brand and an image to protect. We can't see any economic benefit. Why should we consider going there?
Very good, yes. We here in Auckland, I've been to a number of council meetings where we are wanting Auckland City in many ways to be the gatekeeper to keep out any GMO or GE food going into the Northland region, as it's a peninsula, so that Northland can produce real vital, organic, nutrient-dense food, and it could even then naturally be not only exported, but anybody in that Northland and Auckland region could eat very high-quality food. Another thing that I'd like to be able to say is that with the EPA, a lot of them want to be friendly with the big boys, and I've noticed that. I used to work in first class for Air New Zealand, and I used to, in those days, have the New Zealand Business Roundtable on board the flights, and they were going over to Australia and back, and I got in close and I saw how some of these men were, mainly always men, and they're a club, and they don't want to upset the other members of that particular establishment, and I can see why IRMA and EPA don't want to rock the boat, and I'll say it to them straight. There's a major dishonesty there going with them, and the other thing is a lack of spine. So I am really pleased that you can articulate this so well, Phyllis, because New Zealand has got so much possibility. And I'll swing this right round. When Arden Anderson came down and from the States and started plugging in people to the fact that the connection between the human gut and the soil microbes, and Graham Sate, who was born in Taranaki here and went over to Australia, and now he's got the Woolworths and South Africa, and they've got over 500 supermarkets only sourcing food and produce from biological farmers, means that, as you say, there is a growing consciousness around what we take into our body. And I am very, very hopeful now that the farmers are shifting, and I'm coming across farmers more and more, and I mentioned this name of biological agriculture, and they say, oh yes, I'm doing it, or my next door neighbour's doing it. So there's a big shift happening, isn't there?
Absolutely, and I want to reiterate your message of hope on this. Organics has had bad general rap here in New Zealand, and being totally blunt about it from a humorous standpoint, I've observed over the last 25 years that many rural New Zealanders view organics as something that's hippie or something that's not based on science. Certainly based on science, and it's not just hippies who do it. And I really wish to, you know, get the message out there to farmers that if you were to go organic, for example, in dairying now, even before the organic milk payout jumped from, you know, $5 to $9.20 a kilogram milk fob, even before that meteoric rise, an organic dairy farmer last year would be making X. A paired, similar farm type size cow's infrastructure intensity would have been losing 3X at that payout of last year. Now, of course, instead of making about $5 a kilogram milk solid, organic dairy farmers are making $9.20. It's one of those, you do the math. And for farmers who do convert to organics, I assure them that they do not have to wear jandals, they do not have to grow a beard, and they do not have to stop wearing deodorant. It's, you know, seriously, guys, it's not like that. It is a science-based program that regenerates soil, improves human health, both for the farmer and his family, and for the people who eat the produce, and is seriously in demand worldwide. Having recently returned from a visit home to see family in California, I was blown away by the number of organic products, everything you can possibly imagine, and including new stores specifically tailored to only sell organic foods. And this is above and beyond Whole Foods, which known worldwide as having that focus. These are smaller scale independent stores who are catering to this demand, and it's growing like wildfire. It is 20% increases in organic production per year worldwide, and they still can't keep up. So it is definitely something to look at. There is not a drop in production if you move at it from a good basis of biological soil fertilization, and certainly there is tremendous satisfaction in it. The thing that we need to do, though, as I said before, as consumers, we need to vote with our dollars to make it clear to the market that we demand fresh, high-quality, hybrid, nutrient-dense food. And if we're not happy about the way regulatory decisions or local government decisions are being made, it is our responsibility to get sufficiently upset, fearful, if that's what it takes, or flat out angry to write a letter, create a small demonstration, you know, front up, because frankly, no one else is looking after your self-interest. We need to be able to counter through collective action what is the very understandable, concentrated, economic self-interest of people who are creating the products that are ultimately harming us. So if you're actually concerned about this, if you've known someone who's died of breast cancer, I can't imagine that there isn't someone who hasn't known a woman that they care about die of breast cancer, or you're concerned about all of the autism you see, it's over to us to make a fuss.
It's so very true. It's important for us to get off our backsides and do something that's strategic and make it count. Now, I had a friend who just came back from Los Angeles last week, and the first thing they said was, gosh, I didn't know how many organic supermarkets there were up there. I was shocked. And they said, not only that, so many electric cars as well. And so really what's happened is that New Zealand's actually fallen well behind because we're not getting it languaged from the top of government all the way down through the departments, through business, through the education system. They're stymied here and it's very difficult. I mean, I've got a good friend of Stephen Browning, whom you know at the Greens, and he's the only Green who's really green. And he's finding it more and more difficult because he's sort of hanging out in the Green Party with career politicians, and we need to be able to just recognise our connection to the planet. Our planet loans us a body, it loans us free air, free water, and until recently a free food chain. We got to understand reciprocity. What do we give back? And so that's a real big one, and I'm so glad to hear of your enthusiasm and your insight for this, because we are it. We have a huge job to do, and we're seeing the fallout among the sick people and the children having allergies, etc. And when I look at our tiny, tiny markets here, you go to an organic supermarket in Auckland, even though we've got 1.5 million people, we go to a little shop. So there's a great need for a gigantic co-op, organic co-op situation where we can have a big co-op store, and because people put money into it to get it off the ground, they can get a certain percentage of their food bill when they go to a checkout counter, which I've seen up in the States. And that was 40 years ago. So we need to make the effort, don't we?
Yeah, we have situations where it's difficult increasingly for us. Yes, our lives are busier and we're doing more things and things happen faster, but our general health is gradually stair-stepping down for the most part. And that creates a bit of a conundrum, because just when we need to be more vigilant about what we're eating and how we're preparing it and where it's coming from and what its value is, it's harder and harder for us to do that as our health deteriorates. So my suggestion is absolutely to people, try to eat organically, and if there's a way that you can grow more of your own food or connect with local farmers in some fashion, absolutely, I encourage that. And I think people need to look at their assumptions about the cost of organic food. Yes, for the most part, it does cost more than conventional food, but you're not only getting more actual vitamins and minerals in most organic food than you do in conventional. It doesn't end up costing you a whole lot more in terms of your health from the pesticides and herbicides that you're taking on as well. So it's a longer term calculation in terms of the true cost of conventional food versus organic food. So I do encourage everyone to do what they can to provide their own vegetables or create a community garden. You made the suggestion of creating a cooperative. That's certainly a model that works in many communities, larger communities in the United States, but informal buying clubs can certainly work as well on a smaller scale. But once again, putting the political pressure on our ag organizations and on central government to go back to adopting or to forcefully and proactively help to move New Zealand agriculture in a more regenerative, more biological, and ultimately a more organic orientation, because it's the organic and biological farming that actually is capable of sequestering hundreds of thousands of tons of greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere and storing them long-term in the soil. That is one of the more urgent and important things we can do. And we know from the work of Christine Jones and others like her and the work of Alan Savory that keeping a constantly living, healthy root in the soil and plants that are fully nourished and high bricks, which means, in effect, no sprays, those are the plants capable of pulling unimagined previously amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere to bring those greenhouse gas levels down rapidly. That's the sort of thing we need to be encouraging government to do for us and move towards truly premium end market, not coasting on our impression of how clean or green we imagine New Zealand to be, because, frankly, it uses just as much pesticide and herbicide and synthetic fertilizer and toxic chemicals as most other places. We just happen to have fewer people in a larger country with a lot of water and a lot of wind. So it's not as apparent to us that we are poisoning our environment. But rest assured, there have been studies, most of them ignored, that indicate we are polluting our own nest. That's only not good for our health and our image overseas. It's certainly not good for tourism. So absolutely, it's incumbent on us to take the personal actions to make a difference.
Very good, yes. And making that difference, we are. I just wish to say thank you so much for this. You did a wonderful job of what we need to be aware of, what we need to do, and then taking action, particularly for the sake of our children and our grandchildren. Lovely to speak with you, Phyllis. I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
And thank you very much, for Tim, for what you do. I'm delighted that you're carrying the candle in the hurricane and everything we can do to reduce the force of the winds and keep that flame growing is tremendous, and you're contributing mightily in that direction. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Rightio, well, we will catch up again.
Thank you for the opportunity, Tim.
That was Phyllis Titchenan, formerly of California, now here. She is the owner of True Health Limited down in Havelock North in the Lower Hawke's Bay. You can listen to many previous interviews at planetaudio.org.nz/greenplanet 5 minutes after 9 a.m. for the next 7 days, and iPod and stream can be obtained 6 hours after broadcasting. GreenPlanetFM.com has a huge database of interviews in the archive. You can also subscribe to iTunes.com. Green Planet. If you do, could you please put a comment, just a quick comment, so that iTunes can pick up on it. And you can also follow Green Planet FM on facebook.com/greenplanetfm and twitter.com/greenplanetfm. In the spirit of Aroha, I say Kia Kaha and Hari Ra.